produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from March 10th through April 1st at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Golda's Balcony is the final work for Tony Award-winning playwright William Gibson. The play is a portrait of Golda Meir, an Israeli teacher, kibbutznik, stateswoman, and politician, and the fourth elected prime minister of Israel. Again, that's Golda's Balcony, March 10th through April 1st at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein. The screening is Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center. Gaining Ground is a film about growing food, empowering communities, and changing lives. It also addresses the negative impacts of industrial agriculture and genetically modified foods. It is an intimate view of rural and urban farmers embracing challenges. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center, Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 934 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer Melissa Phoebos. Phoebos' work has appeared in everything from Tin House, Granta, the Kenyon Review, and Guernica, to the New York Times, Glamour Magazine, and Salon, as well as being featured on NPR's Fresh Air, CNN, and Anderson Cooper Live. Her essays have twice received special mention from the Best American Essays Anthology and won prizes from Prairie Schooner, Story Quarterly, and the Center for Women Writers. Melissa Phoebos teaches creative writing at Monmouth University and is on the writing faculty at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and serves on the board of directors of VIDA, Women in Literary Arts, and the PEN America Membership Committee. Phoebos is the author of the critically acclaimed memoir Whip Smart from St. Martin's Press that chronicles her struggles with addiction and her time working as a dominatrix in Midtown Manhattan. Guernica says of Whip Smart that on one level it is a tantalizing twist on the classic artist coming-of-age epic, and on the other, it's queer critical theory disguised as narrative. Melissa Phoebos is here today on Between the Covers to talk about her second and much anticipated memoir, Abandon Me, just out from Bloomsbury. Kirkus Reviews calls it a courageous exploration of love as the ultimate form of plenitude and annihilation. Publishers Weekly says Phoebos' mastery over metaphor is astonishing. What might be mere navel-gazing for a less brilliant author is made powerfully universal here. And author Kiese Lehman says it is rare to read a book as generous as it is genius, weaving familial stories, feminist stories, communal stories, and love stories, all at once revealing much of where she's been and where we, her readers, might go if we dare. Welcome to Between the Covers, Melissa Phoebos.
Thank you, David Naiman.
This being your second memoir, what were the questions after Whip Smart that cohered into an impulse to write Abandon Me? And maybe as a corollary to that, I noticed that a lot of the pieces of Abandon Me are standalone essays, or mm-hmm. some version of them were standalone essays in various literary magazines. When you were writing them, did you have an idea of a book, or did that come later as you were writing the essays?
Oh my God, that question has so many little segments. It's like a pomegranate. I'm going to start with your first question, which was about the questions, I assume you mean inside of me, mm-hmm. That led to reading this book. And, you know, I don't know if I had articulated questions when I started this book. I think I had these long gestating questions for a lot of my life that were sort of rising to the surface. But mostly when I began this book, and this book began unlike my other book, unlike anything I've ever written, where I was in this maelstrom of experience, much of which I describe in the book. And I just had the thought, and maybe it was like a life preserver of a thought, that I was going to write a book about it. And the book was going to be called Abandon Me. So maybe as a survival mechanism, but I was sort of called to it by my psyche in the middle of like a very, very painful time. You know, it's funny because I find it really interesting that people understand the book as a memoir, because there's a long and probably boring story to anyone who's never experienced anything similar to the subtitle, which is memoirs, because I think of the book as a collection of essays. But marketing departments have different ideas about what it should read on a book's cover. And so we split the difference between memoir and essays and said memoirs.
But no, I didn't even notice that it was memoirs.
Yeah, people don't seem to have a problem with it, so which speaks well to the coherence of them working together. But I wrote them as distinct essays. And I didn't know that they were part of the same book. I had this idea about this book I was going to write, which made the sort of pain I was in at the moment feel like it might be worth something someday. And then I was writing these bizarre, extremely challenging and engrossing essays on the other hand. And, you know, those two things started to sort of move together in this glacial way until they finally met. And I realized that all of these essays were part of a whole.
Yeah. It's interesting that you bring that up, because it does feel like you can tell that some of these are standalone pieces, but they all do function in as one organic whole in some miraculous way at the same time, I think.
Thank you. I mean, they definitely feel related.
Yeah.
And by related, I mean, I think they all have the same DNA, not just because they were made out of me, but I was sort of trying to figure something out in each of them, and it turned out to be kind of the same thing.
When you were on Sherman Alexie and Jess Walter's podcast, Tiny Sense of Accomplishment, you talked about how you had a revelation as a writer that you can write about the same thing over again. That at one point you felt like once you've written it, it was done, and then you had to move on to some other idea. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yes, that was revelation? So important, and if not for that revelation, I would not have written this book. I mean, this book is dependent upon the understanding that you can revise your ideas about things and that they transform and evolve or reverse. I think probably the most liberating revelation, both in writing and life, for me has been that I'm allowed to change my mind and be flexible in that way. And, you know, my first book was about a very specific experience, that of, you know, shooting heroin and working as a professional dominatrix, and at least on the surface. And, you know, you can't sort of bury that lead in a different kind of story without people knowing that you're writing about the same experience. And so it felt so specific and so landmark that I found in the years after that book was published, a lot of that material would start working its way into things I was writing about. And, you know, sometimes it would be material from my actual experiences in the dungeon. And then sometimes it would just be material about sexuality or gender roles or my own relationship to my body or money and sex. And I had this, I would recoil from it, as if I was no longer allowed to talk about that. I had said everything, you know, at the age of 28 or whenever I wrote that book, that I could say about, you know, gender and sex work and spanking. And, you know, the truth is that I think I'll probably have many more things to say about spanking before I'm done. And that, you know, if you go back, as I'm sure you have as a reader, and read any author's body of work, they're always doing this. They're chewing on the same cud for their whole career. And part of the pleasure and where I think our loyalty to certain writers comes from is that we share those obsessions.
Yeah.
And we enjoy vicariously experiencing or even sharing that progression of ideas and that changing of mind. And so it sort of keeps us company and gives us permission at the same time.
That's a great way to put it. You open the book with a chapter called The Book of Hours, where we see how central stories were to you both as a way to cope with your sea captain father's long absences at sea, but also later a way you found to establish intimacy with a lover to bridge distances. both emotional distances and actual geographic distances. Can you talk a little bit about story's function for you in a formative sense? Some of the ways you're exploring the way story actually shaped you and your psychology?
It's interesting because I used to have a quicker answer for this, but I'm not sure if I believe that stories shaped the way that I exist or perceive the world or make sense of things. I really sort of believe at this point that the mind inherently thinks in narrative, right? The narrative is something natural to us. It's a way that the mind makes sense of this incredible influx of information and pain and transformation, right? We build it into an arc and, you know, the very same sort of shape that Aristotle talked about in Poetics and Freytag's Triangle. And I don't think we invented that. I think we just sort of gave a name to it the same way that we give names to anything we like to diagnose. But that's a more clinical perspective. And I think from a very young age, I felt overwhelmed by that influx of stimulus, by which I mean sort of life and my own feelings. And I think I have this in common probably with a lot of writers and storytellers or people who build their life around building narrative. I started using stories really early on to make sense of things because it was just too much and I needed a container that made sense so that I could figure out what to hold on to and what to let go of. And, you know, so I was obsessed with books as soon as I learned to read. I read the way that I later smoked crack or the way that I write or run long distances now. But even when I was a little kid, I would sort of go out into the woods and just construct some kind of story in my mind and like wander around alone inside of this theater of my own imagination and found a lot of relief in that. So I had this very intimate sort of private relationship to story. But then within my family, story was, and I described this in the book, story was how we found comfort in my family for things that otherwise made us feel inconsolable. And as you said, it was a way of bridging distances that couldn't be bridged otherwise, you know, most notably my father being a sea captain and being away all of the time. And so there was this sort of endless waiting and experience of missing. And as a young child, an inability to really understand what that meant. And I think my mother learned to tell us stories because it worked, yeah. You know? And then at, you know, anything that you pour into a mind that's that young and hungry for comfort or knowledge or whatever is going to work its way into the foundation, you know? So the Chronicles of Narnia are for me what the Bible is, I think, to many, many more people.
I particularly gravitated to your meditation on the story of Ferdinand, which I didn't know about. And
didn't know about the story of Ferdinand?
I didn't.
You'd never heard of it?
Uh-uh. I confess. But it was interesting to learn it was Gandhi's favorite book, that Hitler burned it, that Hemingway was so offended by it that he had to write something in response. But tell us what role it was playing for you and your family.
Ferdinand was one of our sort of primary texts in my early childhood. And, you know, there's a very familiar photo in one of my mother's albums. I hope your listeners are old enough to remember what photo albums are. Probably they are. Of me lying on my back on my father's belly and him holding Ferdinand, which has a very notable cover, really recognizable cover. And I describe it in the very beginning of the essay. And I think it wasn't the most important book of my childhood, but it was my father's favorite book to read to me. And so the experience of hearing that story is completely merged with the emotional experience of being close to my father, yeah. Right? Which was something that I craved half the time as a child. And so it has this very particular preciousness to me. And, you know, I have that experience of all of my favorite books when I was young, I would read sort of over and over again. I have the same experience of music where I listen to songs over and over and over and over again. And so they become totally fused with whatever other sensory or emotional experiences I'm having at the time and become these really dimensional sort of emotional time capsules. Mm-hmm. Like I think of certain books from my childhood and they come with a set of smells and emotions and light coming through the window at a certain angle.
It's interesting in the book, you mostly refer to your father in the book as the captain mm-hmm. and to your partner as my beloved. And I was wondering about this, if you chose this intentionally as a way to heighten the sense of story of your life, mm-hmm. the story in your life and the story of your life, to change the way that we relate to it as a reader, yeah. to make them characters. That something that was being
played
with?
You know, it's interesting. There's this really wonderful and also humbling experience of being in interviews sometimes, and the interviewer points out something about your work that you didn't know, but that you realize is absolutely true, and that just happened.
Yay.
Where, you know, I sort of made those choices by instinct and also just for clarity's sake to differentiate, because there are two fathers right. and to differentiate the characters. But I also think that those two characters are figures in my life who were very romantic, right? They were people who were not present. And about whom I thought a lot. And romance is inevitable, I think, when that's the case. You know, the more you think about something rather than experience it, the more you build an idea that is distinct from the actual person or thing that you're thinking about, mm-hmm. right? And so I think the captain became this thing that I was craving, this symbol for a kind of love or attention or security that I didn't have access to and was, you know, dreaming about, like the girl at a window and the painting that I describe in the book. And the beloved, I think like all beloveds, at least in the early phases, was also a screen on which I could sort of project even that longing from my childhood, right? And so it made sense to me that at least for the first half of the book, she was this sort of universal figure, you know, because a lot of my yearning and hysteria and obsession wasn't per se about her, the individual person. It was about the idea of her and an idea of a certain emotional reality that I wanted.
Yeah. In case you just tuned in, we're talking to writer Melissa Phoebos about her latest collection of memoirs, Abandon Me. So this use of names, the process of naming, feels like it becomes one of the ways you meditate on language in Abandon Me, which is interesting because in a way, you use other people's stories in the books you love as ways to name yourself. Mm. And yet at the same time, you struggle with your own name, mm-hmm. The name you didn't choose and which in some ways you didn't feel connected to. Mm-hmm. Can you parse out some of the ways you struggle against your name and work to try to find a way to name yourself?
Whoa. Yeah. Yeah, I can talk about that. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny because that essay about my name was the first one that I wrote in the book, and I didn't think it was an essay. I thought it would be a very small paragraph that was a part of something else, and I just wrote the lines. I was trying to describe the way that my name felt to me and how it felt soft in a way that was more vulnerable than I wanted to be, more vulnerable than my own self-conception was. And I wrote a few lines about it being like a ribbon. And then I just kept going and I kept going. And paragraph by paragraph, it unfurled and I discovered sort of the symbolism inherent in my name and how it was this word that sort of signified all of the parts of me that I wanted to at least at one time reject or hide, and that I still think I'm tangling with that. And I've gotten the responses that I've gotten to that essay, because it's been published a couple times, has been almost without exception. I find that people have this incredibly intimate relationship to their own name, you know? And I think, I mean, it makes perfect sense, right? That the word and the set of sounds that gets referred to as you at every single stage of your life, you know? I mean, we are presenting the version of ourselves that we've created, that we have control over, hopefully, as an adult. But inside of our own minds, we're every humiliated moment and orgasm and self-hatred and all of it, right? And the name becomes like this little prism for everything we've ever been. And so how could it not be this incredibly precious and also repulsive thing as our most inner selves are, right? So Melissa always sounded like a girl's name, and I was so conflicted about being a girl, as I think all girls are because our culture is, you know?
It made me think of one of your epigrams, the one by Winnicott. Mm. It is a joy to be hidden and a disaster not to be found.
I've been carrying that epigraph around from notebook to notebook for so many years, and it almost became the epigraph of my first book, but it just wasn't right. Yeah. And I was so glad, because I knew well before I finished this book that it would work for this one. Because that's one of my favorite quotes of all time.
Well, one of the things I love about your writing is this sense of discovery happening on the page. And with that essay on your name is one example. So with your name, Melissa, for instance, you convince us why it doesn't feel like a good fit. How it doesn't fit how you perceive yourself or present yourself. And you move away from what it represents, a certain softness and vulnerability. And you move so far away that in the moving away is when you really discover the power of that softness and the truth of the softness for yourself in having abandoned it or tried to abandon the name. And I feel like we discover that as you do on the page.
I have competing thoughts. Yes, that's very astute. You're a very good reader. Did that sound patronizing? I hope not. It feels good to be read.
You can give me a gold star off
accurately. It feels like this happy little hall of emotional mirrors, because it means that you're a good reader and also that I did my job correctly. But yes, that is very much sort of what happened as I was writing it. And I think, you know, it's strange because it's so incredibly f-ing uncomfortable, the process of discovering something as it's happened, you know, like, I don't want to be a beginner at anything. And it's very thrilling and terrifying to write something and not know where it's going and not have the answer and be exposing more of yourself with every sentence, which is what a lot of this book felt like writing. But that is ironically the very thing I read for, and that I think particularly the essay is meant to do, right? Essayer, it's meant to try. That's what Montaigne was trying to do, is figure something out or have a thought process that was, you know, happening on the page that the reader could enter into with him. And so I did do that with this book, and it was terrifying. It sort of defied all of my other habits in writing. I really was groping in the dark. Well, through most of this.
Let me ask you about that on a craft level. Mm-hmm. At one point you say, this is not a story about learning to love myself. My name is not a symbol. It is coded with all of this, the unseen, the near known, and the rather not known. And in another place you say, it is hard to reveal something you don't understand. And yet it feels like something you do achieve in Abandon Me. So when you're thinking of your own writing or teaching writing to others, or when you were being taught writing as a writing student, do you have any thoughts on how you go about evoking or preserving the unknown on the page, trying to reveal things you don't understand before you understand them?
Mm. Yes. I have a lot of thoughts about that. I mean, most importantly, I think I try to tell this to my students. I think it sounds like it doesn't make sense to them, but I think that it's so important for me to trust my imagination and to trust the unconscious insight that I have. Because I have a lot more than I have access to, right? Like, what's happening on the surface that I'm aware of all the time is mostly neuroticism. It's just like thinking, right? It's like thinking and worrying and trying to preserve my own dignity or whatever. And none of that is what I need to write about. What I need to write about is you have to sort of trust your instincts, right? Which I did in this book more so than anything I've ever written. And it was terrifying. And I couldn't stop doing it, right? So I had to start writing about the way my name sounded. And when I got pulled into that, keep going, right? And so I sort of wrote each of these essays, which turns out to be a series of stories, as you described, about trying to abandon something and circling right back around to it in the end and embracing it, which sounds so corny when I say it, but that really is what happened is.
And it's also, thrilling when you experience it.
Yes, it is. And, you know, very much like, this might be the thing that I'm writing about for the rest of my life. I mean, my first book was certainly about that, about, you know, thinking, taking on this harder name and this harder haircut and this violent job and taking drugs and thinking all of that was going to make me tough, right? And then letting go of it piece by piece by piece and then figuring out that the bravest possible thing I could do is be soft, right? Is let myself stay soft. And I think it was the same with my name, right? That I had to circle back around and own the fact that I was a girl. I was soft. I am, you know, I had a conversation with my mother after she read this book. And one of the things she said to me was, God, when you were a kid, I used to be so scared for you because you were so kind. Like I was this very soft, sort of open, available person. And she, you know, having her knowledge of the world, was like, what's gonna happen to this little person when she goes out there like this? And well, now I've chronicled everything that did happen. Yeah.
Well, maybe this is a good time for people to hear a little bit from Abandon Me. Do you have something in mind that you could read?
Well, since we've talked about it, I thought maybe I would read the beginning of Call My Name.
Great.
And because it's an essay that's so much also, maybe more so than any of them, it's interested in phonics and sound and the way that words and emotion and meaning and identity all merge. When I was 7, my sea captain father at sea, my mother a strobing lighthouse of missing, I stood alone in my bedroom, renaming all my toys, Melissa, you and you and you, a child's narcissism, maybe, a punishment for my dolls. I didn't choose my name, but I could choose to give it away, a small triumph. But no matter how many dolls I christened Melissa, the sound of my name still shocked me. Hum of M, soft L, hiss ending open mouth. Melissa, my teacher called each morning. Here, I flinched. It was a ribbon of sound, a yielding, sibilant thing. Drag it along a scissor blade and it curls. I wanted a box, something with corners I could feel. Zoe or Katrina, those girls ruled the school bus. You could press your fingers into Melissa. It was hum and ah and s, more sigh than spit. On family vacation in Florida, after days pickling in the hotel pool, eyes pinked from its blue brine, my mother asked me, Melissa, why, when the ocean was steps away, why the pool? Because the pool has sides, I told her. I was already spilling out, grasping for edges, and what chance did I stand against the ocean? How many times had the sea taken our captain and left her beating the shore with her hands? It was an early lesson. The ocean disappears things. It is a hungry, grabbing thing. In its deep, there is nothing to reach for. Next to it, I was a girl gulping a woman's grief.
You've been listening to Melissa Phoebos read from her latest collection of memoirs, Abandon Me. Melissa, you've said before that the question of duality and the interrogation of false binaries is at the heart of most writing that interests you. And you quote Fitzgerald when you say, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. And I think of this in relationship to Abandon Me, in particular around how you highlight and interrogate the meaning of different words here with Melissa, but also I think of the word tender, which you take apart and defamiliarize, showing us that it has two meanings sort of in tension with each other, the a gentle feeling, a tender feeling, and mm-hmm. also an ache, a pain, and a vulnerability. Mm. It feels tender. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could do this for us for the word abandon. Mm. Talk a little bit about the meaning of the word and the meanings of the word that maybe aren't comfortable coexisting with each other, but do coexist under the same word.
Right. Well, you know, I love the word abandon, and I love the word tender, and I don't yet love my name, but we have an uneasy alliance, and I think that's for the very reason that you're talking about, that they hold all of it, right? They hold, the polarities exist within the word, in the dictionary definitions of the word, and abandon, I mean, I also just love the sound of that, the sort of seesaw of abandon, and it makes perfect sense to me that this supposed binary that exists inside of the word abandon has to do with this sort of letting go, right? On one end, you have the experience of being left, being abandoned, and what's implied in that is a yearning or not wanting to be left, right? There's a danger there, there's a risk. And at the other end of it, to abandon oneself to something, right, is to let it go, to let it be free. And there's a swelling sort of joy in that, right? And so to me, they seem almost like a question and an answer. The same way that the word tender, which is a word, you know, I don't know if other writers have this. I think they probably do, but there are certain words that I use so often that I have to go back after I've written something and do a search to see how many times I've used it and then employ some synonyms because it seems right in so many cases. And tender seems like the question of pain is answered best with softness, right? That ache is to sort of soften into an ache, right? That's what they tell you, you know, if you fall, go limp, right? Or even if, you know, I've been tattooed many times and there's always, my first reaction to it is to tense my body up and to fight it and to try to sort of push it away in my mind. And that doesn't help. That doesn't lessen the pain. What does is to sort of let it happen, to soften myself and just let the sensation in, because any acute sensation that I've experienced is not at its core good or bad or all pain or all pleasure. It just enters into this sort of middle area that's just human, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why all my favorite books are funny/sad, right? Because those are the most acute feelings that we have existing.
Yeah. The book is anchored by the essay or the memoir, Abandon Me, which is over half the length of the book. And it dramatizes your abandonment to a very passionate on and off long distance mm-hmm. relationship with a married woman mm-hmm. and braids that with your newfound curiosity about your biological father mm-hmm. and by extension your native heritage. Mm-hmm. And it's in this section that you talk about how you've never been abandoned in a relationship by mm-hmm. your partner, and you tie this into the imago theory of relationships. Mm-hmm. And so in this, you say that to face your imago and walk through it is to reenact the most painful part of your beginnings. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about what an imago is. Since we're talking about naming and representation and sure. mirroring, it seems like the imago is another perfect example of or mm-hmm. iteration of this theme.
So the imago theory basically postulates that we experience primary wounds in our early childhood, usually through our caregivers, and we go out into our adult lives with these wounds, and we seek out relationships that will recreate those narratives because our psyche is seeking resolution. So basically, we want to relive the same story, but to get a different ending. And you know, I love this for sort of the same reason that I love words like tender and abandon, because it takes this idea of a binary or a dichotomy or a polarization between sort of self-destructive behaviors and self-soothing behaviors. And it's proof, it's an explanation for how those can be the same thing, which is something that I've always understood inherently about myself, that my tendency towards behaviors and experiences that might objectively be seen as self-destructive or bad or depraved, they never felt like that to me. They felt like a different kind of seeking. They felt like a way of looking for something else, sometimes for God, sometimes for comfort, sometimes for insight. And the Imago theory is sort of like the urge of that, right? Yeah. And I think the analogy in Abandon Me ended up being kind of obvious, though it didn't occur to me while it was happening, that I picked this long-distance lover and who I'm obsessed with, and I build this story around, and you know, it's this longing that really sort of defines my life for a time, which is, I could use those exact words verbatim to describe the experience of having a father who was a sea captain, right? Yeah. So in some ways it's reductive, and in some ways it's really fun and accurate to apply that model to my own experience.
Speaking of these polarities, bringing together these polarities under the same roof, the walking through to reenact the most painful part of oneself reminds me of the phrase elsewhere in the book, being destroyed to become someone else. And it also reminds me of you discussing your father, your sea captain father's negative response to Whip Smart, which wasn't so much about your sex work, but was about your portrayal of him and your relationship with him, and how that portrayal really broke his heart. And when you were talking about that, it was interesting because at the same time as it broke his heart, you also describe that it was only when his heart was broken that the two of you started to have an authentic relationship together. And it feels like it's got this weird contradiction and tension in it. But it allowed the two of you to feel close in a way that felt mutually authentic. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, I think that the experience I had with my father, which is an experience that I have since imposed on other members of my family, typifies my experience of writing about my own experience, which is that I have to identify a narrative that I've constructed, not as a writer, but just as a human being living. And we started the interview talking about this. And, you know, I think we build a self-conception, we build a narrative out of our experience, not so that it will be the most accurate record of what happened, but because it helps us to live with it. And then in order to come to a deeper, more nuanced understanding of that, we have to destroy it in some way. We have to annihilate that story. And that can feel like an act of violence to our psyche. And so I've never been on the other end of that experience, but I can imagine that for my father or for anyone, having another person, for instance, your daughter, a writer, come in with a sledgehammer and annihilate your narrative about yourself or who you were to her as a father can feel like a tremendous act of violence. And I think it did to him, even though my writing it, that was not at all my intention. You know, I just sort of necessarily implicated him when I was annihilating my own story about myself, as one does, which is a good reason to not write memoir or maybe a good reason to write it. But it's an experience that I've had to recreate every time I've written something. I think I have that experience myself, but I get to have it privately and I get to modulate when I take a break or how it goes when someone else is doing it to you. You know, I've learned to have a lot of empathy for how hard that must be.
Well, to follow this thread about writing memoir and potentially risking breaking the heart of people close to you, you say at one point that we all craft a story we can live with, the one that makes ourselves easier to live with, and this is not the one worth writing, which I believe is what you were just referring to around this. But the one that you do write, where you abandon yourself to love and a lover to such a degree that some of your friends are worried that it's an addiction, I wondered about this in relationship to your sense of heartbreak and creating new opportunity, you know, self-destruction leading to rebirth. Did you have to put any sort of blinders on to write that relationship? so close to the bone and not worry about your ex-partner's response? Did you share it with her before you published it? Have you had to deal with blowback, if you're willing to share? how do you go about, as a memoirist, the anticipation of it, or pushing away the anticipation of a response if you don't want to grapple with it? Or if you do want to grapple with it, how do you grapple with it?
Well, I mean, I think every memoirist has to keep a pair of blinders in her back pocket at all times, because they're the most necessary tool. You can't do anything if you can't banish the thoughts of what other people are going to say or think. I mean, you won't write anything, you know, or you'll construct a story that doesn't have a heart because you don't want to break someone else's. And for better or worse, I am gifted at dissociation and detachment and compartmentalization. And I've worked very hard and spent a lot of money on therapy to undo that tendency. But it comes in very handy when I'm writing, because I absolutely cannot think about what other people are going to think or say about what I'm writing, or I won't be honest. I have too much of an impulse to keep everyone happy all of the time. I think a lot of us do. But this book also is different from other things I've written in the sense that it was harder for me not to think about that as I was writing it. I think partially because I spent so long, I spent 2 years in this mad love affair constructing a story that I wanted to be true. And I was so devoted to that story, and it felt so violent to have to undo that. And it felt like a doubly betraying, because she and I were the only people who existed inside of that narrative, and we shared it. It was a shared narrative until the very end. And to undo it, you know, she and I are not in contact and weren't even when I was writing it, and there was no way for me to say, like, I remember all of it, not just the part that belongs in this story, you know? And it's sort of painful not to be able to communicate that, and I tried a little bit in the book. But so the first version that I wrote of that final essay, which is, as you said, more than half the book, you know, I gave it to two of my most trusted readers, and they were both friends who had been present for the experience and had fielded my desperate phone calls during that time. And they read it, and both of them independently responded and said, this is a beautiful story, but this is fiction. This is not what happened. And my one friend was more blunt and said, I don't know if you're trying to write a story that she'll be okay with, or if this is the story that you'll be okay with. She said, but this is, people will read this, but it doesn't entirely make sense, and it's definitely not what happened. And I went home and I thought, and I had to I locked myself in the apartment for a week, and I thought, okay, like, I'm going to have to put in the things I really don't want to look at in myself, and some parts of her that I don't want to have to expose either. And I did the minimum amount that I thought was necessary, and I think it's enough, you know?
Yeah.
But as with all memoir, I had to leave most of it out.
That's interesting. You gave a talk sort of on this topic, a TED Talk, Telling Your Secrets Can Set You Free. And I think you might have already answered the questions of the limits to the ability of secrets to set you free, that you do have sort of a negotiation with the secret telling in a way.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, secrets, I'm a secretive person by nature. I think a lot of writers are. I think most addicts are too. But I know I am. And I think the idea that telling your secrets sets you free, I don't mean by that that telling your secrets sets you free from pain or regret or heartbreak. It sets you free from your secrecy, which is still a very important kind of freedom, you know? My experience of secrecy is that it's constructing a small world, a little piece of reality that you inhabit alone and that you can control, which is the benefit of it, but it's not exposed to the elements of other people and whatever kind of objective reality you believe in. And once that's done, the construction crumbles, right? But then you get to exist. That part of you that was alone in that little piece of reality gets to enter into the world, and it's a much bigger space, you yeah. know? So I still have all my heartbreak and my regrets and all of those memories. They don't go away. I'm not free of them, but I'm not alone in them either.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to writer Melissa Phoebos about her collection of memoirs, Abandon Me. Another thing I think about when I think about the question of how to write memoir that isn't about the story that makes ourselves easier to live with and how not to get derailed by the response of others. I also think of your first memoir, Whip Smart, and it seems like that book was really well received on the whole. But in looking into it a little bit, there are corners of the sex world that weren't so happy about Whip Smart. And your answers around that were really astute, I thought, that you didn't write the book with the intent of representing anyone other than your own experience, mm-hmm. but that people nevertheless feel threatened if there aren't a lot of representations, particularly mm-hmm. marginalized groups, that becomes the de facto representation, mm-hmm. even if it mm-hmm. wasn't your intention, mm-hmm. in perhaps not positive ways for some people. So mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about that experience and how you grappled with that.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the surprises. And in hindsight, I think I shouldn't have been surprised because it makes so much psychological sense. But when the book came out, my publicist set up an interview with an acknowledged dominatrix writer. And, you know, he was like, this will be great. You know, she'll be like the one person who can really understand. And I was like, awesome. And then I proceeded to have the strangest interview. I mean, I didn't even have anything to compare it to, but it was not friendly. And this writer also reviewed the book. And in the review, she said very little, maybe nothing, about the craft or quality of the book. She spoke mainly about me as a narrator, you know, through the lens of a fellow dominatrix. And I think she said in the review that she wanted to like reach through the page and slap me or something. It was so personal. And wow. I was devastated, you know, and this was also my first exposure. You know, many of the things I wrote about in Whip Smart, I had never said aloud to anyone ever, not even my therapist. And then I wrote this book, which, you know, writing a book is a very private process. Until then, you're, you know, talking into a microphone about the things you wrote about. And so I was talking right. into a microphone many times the first time I was speaking about a lot of this material. And so it was extremely painful and confounding. And, you know, it was sort of like a pebble in my psychic shoe or maybe just in my heart for a while. And, you know, as a result of that, of not forgetting about it, I started to recognize this experience all over the place. And I started to really develop an ear for hearing writers talk about the experience of being sort of vilified and resented by their own community once they'd written about it. And it makes a lot of sense, right? One person sort of rises into the public eye and suddenly they become, as you said, the de facto representative for that entire marginalized group, you know? And not every writer who is Black wants to be a Black writer speaking for all of Black people, you know? Like, right. you hear that all the time. Just like, I don't necessarily want to be the sex worker writer. I certainly don't want to speak for other sex workers. And this can be, it's a complex experience because on one hand, I do think there's an inherent responsibility. Whether you want it or not, you're going to be perceived that way, and you can disown it, or you can be conscious of that and take on some of that responsibility. And so while I don't think I'm obligated to, I do think it became important for me to acknowledge that my experience was only my own. And I, you know, it really was a profound lesson in learning to manage your own fear as someone who belongs to marginalized groups, as someone whose story doesn't exist in the public sphere. Because our instinct is to want to control how we are represented when that does happen, but to the detriment of our own communities, you know, that's, it's not worth it. So I just want as many sex workers and as many queer people and perverts and people of color and people with Sea Captain fathers to come forth and tell their stories, because I think that's the answer to the problem of having one person represent your whole community.
Yeah. You wrote this great piece in Granta about an excerpt from a Jeanette Winterson novel, an early book of hers called Written on the Body, a piece that you read to almost every classroom of students you encounter. And I was hoping you might just read the little quote before I ask the question.
I would be very happy to. Okay. I might not even have to read it because I have read it so many times. It was a game, fitting bone on bone. I thought difference was rated to be the largest part of sexual attraction, but there are so many things about us that are the same. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. To remember you, it's my own body I touch. Thus she was, here and here. The physical memory blunders through the doors the mind has tried to seal. A skeleton key to Bluebeard's chamber, the bloody key that unlocks pain. Wisdom says forget, the body howls. Thus she was, here and here. Ugh.
You use this quote as a link to a lesson on cliche.
Mm-hmm.
And you say to your students, do not use the word pain ever, or soul, or love, or roses until you can do what Jeanette Winterson does with cliches. These words are forbidden to you.
Mm-hmm.
Your book is similarly brimming with emotion. I think you probably, listeners can hear some affinity, musical or syntactical affinity with Call My Name, which you read earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's brimming with emotion and with the madness of love, as you say in the book, or you say of the Winterson book. What are some of the strategies you use to write with passion, to allow emotion to spill and yet at the same time to avoid cliche or sentimentality if you don't want that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's taken me a long time to sort of get there, and I don't think I'm there where Winterson is, but it's this very intense and arduous process of bringing intense emotion and vulnerability and sustained focus on a particular emotion or experience with incredibly rigorous craft. Like, you just have to burrow, or I just have to burrow into something. It's almost like you have to scratch at the surface of a cliche until you can dig into it, and then you just keep digging and digging and digging until you pop out of the other side of it and you're in a completely different atmosphere, you know. And that's what I love about Winterson. And it's, you know, it's I think it's connected to earnestness, you know, where Annie Dillard does this too, where if you plucked out a certain sentence from her work, this similarly, if you to Winterson's work, if you plucked out the bloody key that unlocks pain, you'd be like, that's terrible. What is that? So dramatic. If I saw that in a student story, I'd slash. I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't even be polite about it. I'd be like, get that out of here. Who do you think you are? But she builds it, right? Like, she writes in this like exfoliative way where she goes into this one very small location of desire and then just peels at it and peels at it and peels at it and peels at it until she arrives at the bloody key that unlocks pain. And so, you know, for instance, in Call My Name, which is probably the most focused exercise in that in the book, I mean, that essay took me longer to write than any single piece of writing I've ever done, because I just whittled those sentences and I whispered my own name to myself thousands of times, you know, and had to really sort of surrender to the feelings and the sounds that were embedded in that word. And at the same time, I had to sort of combine my own words until they flowered into something I hadn't seen before. And it takes a really long time. And for most of the time that you're working, you don't believe it's going to happen.
When I was preparing for this interview, I happened to also be reading an article by June Howard on sentimentality, which looks at the way that the opposition to sentimentalism was partially a coded opposition, both to writing that was seen as feminine or that evoked feminine responses, and writing that was too associated with the body versus the mind. Mm-hmm. And she quotes a takedown that Henry James does to the writing of Rebecca Harding Davis, where he uses all sorts of bodily language as a critique of her writing. So I'm just going to read that really briefly. She drenches the whole field beforehand with a flood of lachrymose sentimentalism and riots in the murky vapor which rise in consequence of the act. Nothing is more trivial than that intellectual temper which, forever dissolved in the melting mood, goes dripping and trickling over the face of humanity and washing its honest lineaments out of all recognition. And the reason why I bring this up is because when you were writing the Book of Hours chapter, the Book of Hours, which we haven't discussed, is a book by Rilke, but it's also these medieval prayer books. You went to the library archives and read some of these original medieval prayer books, some of which were written on animal skins. And you said that this experience was enough to convince you that books were once bodies, that the bestial and the divine can reside in the same place. And that made me think of, I know this is a long question, but this made me think of Lydia Yuknovich when she talks of corporeal literature, the literature of the body. And I was hoping you would talk more about books as bodies or about embodied writing, what that means for you in your writing.
Well, I mean, first, can I just say what an a-hole. He might as well have said she just had her period all over the page. You know, that was like basically his review of her words. It makes me so mad. You know, because I feel like I've experienced something similar. And I think most women who write of the body have a very rude and firsthand experience of, speaking of false binaries, the false binary that's been created by patriarchy between the intellect and the corporeal, right? We can't be intellectual and of the body, right? Because the body is the female and intellectually mute, I suppose, and the intellectual is ideas and useful and powerful in men, right? And this is something that is so deeply embedded in the way that we understand books. I think our earliest studies of books are studies in this false binary, and are teaching us this lesson. And so it's taken me 36 years to sort of undo it. And, you know, I recently wrote an essay for Poets and Writers magazine in which I sort of reclaim the phrase navel gazing, because to me that sort of epitomizes that sort of inherent sexism. And I can't tell you how many female students I've had who are like, oh no, but I can't write about being pregnant because then no one will take me seriously, even if they're a very serious thinker. And we just believe that, you know, and every writer I know has probably had a moment where they've sneered at memoir, or at least experienced the fear of being called navel-gazing if they write about their own story. And where this idea comes from that we can't be intellectual and write our own story, I mean, it makes no sense. It's like the science of race, you know, and it's bad science. It's just bigotry, really, you know? Yeah. And so for me, when I actually look at my own experience of books, it's all about the body, right? Like books are how I learned to inhabit my body, how I learned to withstand the challenge of existing in a human body. And reading and writing are, for me, like, I even noticed as I was reading from my book, I started rocking here in front of the microphone, because story and sound and the body, I mean, these things are actually inextricable, right? It's only in the abstract that we can really separate them. And it's through books like Jeanette Winterson's, like Lydia Yuknovich's, that I first sort of understood that connection and to my own body through language.
Well, thanks for being on Between the Covers today, Melissa.
Thank you. It was so fun.
We're talking today to Melissa Phoebos about her latest collection of memoirs, Abandon Me. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River, 104.3 Philomath, and the Willamette Valley. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting Lila Downs, the indigenous singer-songwriter whose lyrics focus on social justice and often tell the stories of workers who migrate from Mexico to the U.S. Lila Downs performs Sunday, April 2nd at the Newmark Theater. Tickets and info for this all-ages evening with Lila Downs available at portland5.com. And the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And Portland Saturday Market, from our hands to yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.